Welcome to the intersection of technology, cybersecurity, and society. Welcome to ITSP Magazine Podcast Radio. Join us on our journey into the past, the present, and the future as we explore the relationship between technology and humanity. Together, we are going to find out what it means to live in a society where everything is connected and the only constant is change. Knowledge is power, now more than ever.
Here we are, Marco. It's story time.
It's story time, and I have to say it's one of my favorite stories is the beginning story, the first chapter, when you start a book and you're just excited to know what's going on.
I like to start at the end, but that's me.
Well, that's you. You're going to do
like
what you
know
want.
That we're all going to live and prosper and be happy. And but of course, you don't just end up there, right?
Exactly.
It takes a lot to be an overnight success and to have things you can be proud of, and we're gonna have the first chapter of a story shared with us today, and it's by Cynthia Overby, and we're gonna let Cynthia say a few words and say hello to everybody.
Well, hello. I am Cynthia Overby, the president and co-founder of Key Resources, Inc. Key Resources has been around since 1988. We started the company after being bought out by CA, one of the many, many organizations that were bought out by CA. My husband and I decided to spin off and start our own security consulting company. And that was great for many, many years until one day back in 2007, we got a call from a very large financial, multinational financial institution that asked us to come in and do a mainframe pen test, which we hadn't done for a very, very long time. But we went in, Ray and one of his cohorts went in, and they basically told him, you know, we just want to know whether things are tight. We got the impression that they may have been hacked. Ray sat down at a terminal, and he hadn't gotten his credentials yet, but he just started to fool around with ISPF, which is a dialogue for the mainframe. And sure enough, 30 minutes in, before he even had his credentials to get into the system, he had found a vulnerability that allowed him with a simple Rex exec to turn off all of their certificates and access their external security manager.
That sounds like
oh, yeah. So he stood up and called one of the guys over and said, you know, I think we need to have a meeting. And of course, meetings at large financial institutions means there's a number of vice presidents who come running into a room. And so they sat down with about 12 VPs, and he called the guy at the operations center, which was in Dallas, and said, okay, I'm going to execute this Rex exec and tell me what happens. And so he executed it, and the guy goes, oh no, what did you do? And Ray said, you tell me what you see. And the guy said, it looks like you just turned off our external security manager on system XX. And the room erupted into a lot of people jumping up and down. And Ray turned to his cohort and said, I think they're going to take us out back and bury us. And it was very concerned about, you know, what they were thinking. But after everybody settled down a little bit, you know, Ray explained what he had done and what he had found. They went on and finally got their credentials and found quite a few glaring issues.
Before we get into some of those,
sure.
First and foremost, I want to confirm that Ray is okay.
Ray is okay.
Ray is okay. All right, Ray will join us for another conversation.
Yeah. You just ruined the story. You had to keep the suspense here.
So. I know.
We're glad to know that Ray's okay.
Ray's okay. He wasn't okay when he got home and said he wanted to become a software company. And I went, but I'm looking to retire. And he's like, no, I finally found something that we really need to do something about this. You know, I didn't realize there were so many software vulnerabilities on the mainframe. He said, I understand, you know, configuration-based vulnerabilities, but there's software vulnerabilities out there, and we need to do something about it. And I was like, yeah, right. Okay. What does this mean? And by 2011, we had our first vulnerability analysis program service agreement where we were running what we call VAP at another large financial institution and beta testing. And again, finding numerous vulnerabilities, whether they were trapdoors or storage alterations, determining that for as secure as the mainframe is, again, it is just another operating system with software running on it. It's, as I tell people, it's ones and zeros. It doesn't matter what the hardware is. It's ones and zeros, and ones and zeros can be manipulated.
I want to ultimately get to the transition from consulting to software, but right. I want to understand the environment. And so we're looking at 2007. We're a few years beyond that now. I always get the impression that the mainframes are in. You mentioned pen testing a mainframe, and I actually pictured a pen with mainframes in it. just because I think mainframes are these big beasts sitting in some server room somewhere locked in a closet. Everybody forgets about them. Clearly, the organizations you're working with recognize their value and the risk that they pose. Is that the general case back then? Is it still the same now, or have things changed in these few years?
Things have changed. It took a lot of upfront convincing when we first started. And, you know, what we would basically do would be we would pose an offer saying, you know, we'll come in and we'll do a proof of concept. And if we find vulnerabilities, then, you know, you're going to have to sign on. And excuse my French, but we used to call it the oh shit moment, because we would run the software. We would give them the vulnerability detail reports. They would look at them and they would go, yeah, okay. So we've got all these trap doors and from all this system software sitting on our system. And what do we do? The biggest issue we had wasn't so much the technical ability to find vulnerabilities, but it was because there was no infrastructure or policy or procedure around what an individual organization would do with these vulnerabilities. Because at that time, everybody was looking at applications and networks and those types of things. They really, even on the Microsoft side, you know, mainframe vulnerabilities aren't listed in the National Vulnerability Database. And there's a specific reason for that. If there's a vulnerability on a mainframe in the operating system layer or in a third-party piece of software, that vulnerability is running on every single mainframe because it's the operating system. And so IBM and most third-party vendors, the last thing they want is for those vulnerabilities to be listed out there.
Security by obscurity.
Exactly. We call it the conspiracy of silence. And there's valid reasons for it to be that way. And then there's reasons where usually it shouldn't be that way. There are no standards around it. So each vendor has their own vulnerability or integrity database, and you have to basically sign up for that, and you have to monitor it and understand it. And they don't give you a lot of specifics around the basics around a particular vulnerability. what its CVSS level is, et cetera, et cetera. We provide that. We develop standards around categories, types. We have a CVSS scoring methodology, and we do that because it's become sophisticated enough that risk managers want this data in their risk management system. When they report out to the board of directors, they don't want it to just be the vulnerabilities on their network or on their in their cloud or on their Microsoft systems. They want it to be for the whole enterprise. And the mainframe is a huge part of that. The mainframe, you know, people don't seem to realize that when they do a financial transaction today, whether it's a bank transaction, stock market, 401k, it's very likely it's going through a mainframe. An important stat is that by 2030, there will be close to 40 trillion mobile transactions per day going through mainframes. And the reason is because mainframes, the mainframe estate, if an organization needs to process greater than 25,000 transactions per second, it's usually going to stay on the mainframe because that's the kind of horsepower that it actually takes to be able to get the kind of instant gratification to you and I when we go to look up our balance on our checking account. We want instantaneous gratification because we're standing in line to buy something. Mm-hmm. You can't get that off of anything but a mainframe.
Okay, I think this is very important because I guess in general, the public opinion and the idea is everything is on the cloud, everything happened on the internet, everything happened on an app. The truth is there are many industries that are relying, as you're explaining right now, on this. Are there other industry apart from the financial one that are requiring to work on something so responsive with no latency in operating?
Most of your insurance companies today, okay. Their billing systems, a lot of their specific healthcare systems, they run on mainframes. In the retail industry, most of the very large retail systems, their transactions, whether they're going through Visa or Discover or whatever, those are being processed through their mainframes. So most organizations today do have mainframes. And even, you know, people don't seem to realize that if you say cloud, you're saying cloud being an infrastructure. There's a whole heck of a lot of mainframes sitting at Amazon.
Right.
And those mainframes are just as big as a laptop now. Mm-hmm. We have our data center for key resources is about 8x8, and we have 6 stacked mainframes in a rack. And we have enough horsepower that we can run a small country if we wanted to. So, you know, mainframes are based upon MIPS, and those MIPS and those chips are pretty small. So mainframes aren't those big luggable things like they used to be.
Right. And the cloud is still somebody else's computer anyway, right?
Exactly. It's their decision as to what they're going to run it on, whether they're going to run it on a Linux or Unix box or, you know, or a high performance or a mainframe. You know, you sign on the bottom line, and basically your service level agreement says you're going to provide this level of service, and they make the decision as to what to run it on. You don't. So
talk to me a little bit about the infrastructure, and then I'm talking about a company's overall infrastructure, because it seems the security industry does a good job, well, decent job anyway, of wrapping up certain types of machines and certain types of operating systems and certain types of network protocols into an environment that they can monitor and control and respond to when something goes bad. And again, I see these mainframes sitting off to the side, not part of that overall view of risk, mm-hmm. security management, and incident response. Is that a proper view, or have things changed? And based on that, what's your role in helping organizations to maybe connect those dots if they're not already connected?
Sure. Just to give you an idea of the kinds of myths that are out there around the mainframe, Something that we hear a lot of from mainframe operations staffs is, we don't really need extra security around the mainframe because our mainframe is behind the firewall. And I kind of sit there and I go, okay, so everything's behind the firewall, right? What does the mainframe being behind the firewall have anything to do with it being more secure? Or I'm not worried, we use RACF to secure our users and data sets. Well, you know, that's great and wonderful, but that's just user authentication and user permissioning. That has nothing to do with the overall security of the data that's stored on the mainframe. That's, you know, you're not really dealing with the overall issue. We, over the past few years, have done opportunity snapshots with Forrester and had them do some research for us. And this past year, we had them do a snapshot around zero trust in the mainframe, the missing piece of mainframe security, we called it. And one of the stats that was really, really eye-opening was that 86% of the respondents agreed that mainframes are essential for driving a highly scalable workload, and 75% stated that they're critical for business continuity. But only 45% said that that mainframe security is an organizational priority. So there's this disconnect there around, you know, what you really need to do. Now, one of the things that's interesting is that, you know, the first systems that were actually secured, the security discipline itself started with the mainframe. You know, it started back in 1978, back when the first security software was developed for the mainframe. And those security disciplines have grown over the years, but they're based on a basic set of premises. And I think because the mainframe has always been so secure, and that's because of IBM's statement of integrity, that people have just lost a view of the fact that if you're going to run an enterprise, you can't leave your back door open, which is basically what a lot of organizations have been doing. They've been securing everything but the mainframe. So now what we've running into as people are wanting to do zero trust is that they're looking at it and they're going, okay, so zero trust is all about your network, but it's not. Zero trust focuses on protecting resources, your assets, your services, your workflows, and your accounts. And that's across the whole enterprise. That isn't just your network. That encompasses your mainframe enterprise environment. So yeah, you can do zero trust, but if you leave your back door open, what good does that do you if you aren't encompassing everything?
So you need zero trust for the zero trust, by the way.
Exactly.
Well, you know, Sean, it makes me think if marketing was responsible of security, we will be having no problem right now because everything is unhackable. You know, the mainframe is super secure and artificial intelligence is going to save our life and so forth. The truth is that, unfortunately, then you have to look at the creation of this disconnection between the reality and the perception of things. And so, Cynthia, what are the main issues that right now the company is focusing on to maintain and create this security that seems to me it's not just focusing on the mainframe itself? Otherwise, you keep dividing in different compartments your entire IT computer system. It's something that has to run together with other portion of the security, right? So what are the main focus right now on your plate when you start working with a company?
When we start working with a company, we basically, there's a couple of things we go in and we call it the five disciplines around mainframe security. And one of those is that they need a mainframe security architect. A lot of organizations, even at the very highest, you know, highest levels, have architects, security architects, but most of those folks don't have a clue as to how the mainframe functions. So when we go in, we basically go through, you know, a set of discussions, and we explain why you really need a mainframe security architect, because as you're doing more interoperability and you're doing DevOps on the mainframe and you're trying to connect all these pieces together so that people can get the data as quickly as possible that's stored on the mainframe, they need to take a look at all of the points of weak points that they have through that whole process. And we have long discussions about that and what a mainframe architect needs to do. We do come away with a lot of ahas. Okay, that makes sense. There is a role for a person like that. The other thing we talk about, and this has become a huge issue, I think, across the board, is excessive access. One of the things that's happened across the board is that as individual organizations look at data management and the priorities that around putting together an architecture for zero trust, is that excessive access checking is a core part of protecting the mainframe. And to implement any type of compliance checking, you have to clean up your provisioning. We go in and do audits, and we find that when we do a compliance audit, that an organization might have 100,000 excessive access checks because the organization has been so tied into doing their provisioning, adding users, that, you know, changing a user's access or deleting a user or taking away an application programmer's access to the data, production data, becomes a side issue. It's a resource issue more than anything else from a security administration point of view. But you can't do compliance, you can't do zero trust without having a clean understanding of what your assets are. And so we basically tell most organizations, you have to clean up. If you're going to do GDPR, data ownership, you know, if you're going to do zero trust, you have to have a clean external security manager. You have to know who your users are, what data they have access to, and you have to manage that accurately. Because what's
so Cynthia? Cynthia, sorry.
Sure.
So a cleanup on aisle three.
Yeah.
If I look quickly down the aisle and I don't see any mess, I'm not going to bother. So how do you get companies, or how should companies get themselves, perhaps even, to recognize that this world, and maybe this is the way to look at it, I don't know, that line of business owners probably have the view or the control over some of these systems, right? And maybe mm-hmm. IT gets involved, perhaps even less security gets involved, but it's a line of business system, and they don't recognize the risk. They don't recognize the challenge they face with keeping this thing up and running securely and safely with all their data sitting on it. So how do you connect the dots there for the business leaders and the line of business owners to then say, there is a mess on aisle three, even though I can't see it. And I need to make some investments here to identify what my assets are, what the risk is, and the actions to take to mitigate them.
We start with compliance regulations. In the finance world, it's PCI. So we basically start by usually working with a PCI audit vendor, some of our partners, and we'll go in and we use our software, Compliance Assessment Manager, and we'll run through a system and we'll come back and we'll say, okay, here's what you have. And then, you know, we'll match that up against the PCI regulations, whether it's that or a good one is New York State back in 2019 developed a cybersecurity requirement that requires organizations that do financial transactions in the state to do penetration testing and vulnerability assessments. And they delineated between the two, which is, again, another story. But we use that as leverage to get these organizations at the business level to actually start talking about what they need to do in order to be compliant. We have found over the past several years that working with risk managers usually is the right place to start. It's not in operations. They don't have the funding. They're there just to keep the lights on. So what we do is we'll normally make a pitch to the risk management team or, you know, the executive management of the IT risk area. And we'll go in and we'll say, okay, you know, we can either do a pilot, we can, you know, or we can do a full-blown audit, pen test, whatever makes you happy. And because they own the risk and they see the risk when they see the reports that we come up with, and they know that they're out of compliance, they usually have the ability to get to the right people, whether it's at the CIO level or the C or at the C level. They can usually get to the C level and say, "Okay, we are out of compliance, and if we don't fix this and start a project to change our policies and procedures and to make this, you know, we're either going to get hit with GDPR fines, which are in the millions of dollars, or we're going to get hit with a state issue or a federal issue." So that's really how we get organizations to really take a look at some of the things that they need to take a look at and to begin to re-architect how they do security on the mainframe.
Yeah, and it's I'm glad that there's the compliance lever. I'm a little saddened to hear that that's still the one being pulled. I like that you approach the risk officer within the company. I think that that's really where this needs to start, and certainly compliance is part of the risk profile. So what I'm hearing, Cynthia, as we wrap up here, maybe as a recap and then the final word from you as we do that, is these aren't sitting in a pen off on their own. Maybe they may be isolated, and that's probably a good thing if they are, but they need to be treated as part of the overall risk profile and treated as another system with access, other systems and people using it to access data, manipulate data, and complete transactions that seemingly are some of the most important in our society: financial, insurance, health. I can imagine supply chain and all kinds of good things running on them. The cloud. I think a few of us use the cloud every day. So clearly these are important systems that deserve some attention, and not as a, "Oh yeah, but let's go look at these things and then forget about them again for another handful of years," but as part of the overall risk profile and security management program, right?
Correct. I would like to plug the National Institute of Standards and Technology Zero Trust Architecture document that was published in August of 2020. It's SP 800-207. It's an easy read, and it's a good read for anybody that wants to take a look at Zero Trust and the components associated with Zero Trust and understand that when you're looking to do Zero Trust, understanding that it's a cohesive architecture that should be looked at across all of your platforms, and it should, when you're developing your architecture, you know, you should look at it as something that can address your security issues across all of your platforms, not just your network or whatever. A properly implemented Zeta for an enterprise will improve the cybersecurity posture over traditional network perimeter-based security, which I think everyone realizes now that everyone's working at home. You know, you can't look at it from a firewall perspective or a network perspective. It's, you've got to look at it from who's accessing what data from where. And so this really is a paradigm shift And it's something that organizations need to take a hard look at, because if organizations are no longer going to have individuals that are cohesively within a firewall, and they're going to be all over the world, and people are moving now because they don't have to go into an office, that they really need to look at it from a no trust perspective, and from a data perspective, and not from a network vulnerability perspective anymore.
Yeah, well, it's a game of knowing where the exceptions are, minimizing them, and managing them very closely, so that everything else can run smoothly. All right, Marco?
Yeah, and you know, it makes me think about two things to close. One, the mess in the aisle. You may not see it, but maybe there is a problem because the stuff on the shelf is not really well positioned. So you're going to wait for that to fall on the ground. You're going to fix it before it does. So there is that prevention problem that is always have to go with the human mind, which we always wait for the problem to happen. And the second one, which is connected to that and wrap it to the beginning of the story, Cynthia, is the fact that, you know, you started with this Dallas, we have a problem, or the oh shit moment. And that's exactly what we need to avoid. We've gone a long way since when you guys started in 1988, and then the transition into the software business, and now, as you said, it's a constant moving world, digital acceleration, and we just think to we need to think ahead. I think that's the bottom line. And next time that we talk, though, you have to bring Ray, because I want to be sure he's fine.
Okay, I will bring Ray.
I don't know if I trust you.
Zero trust. Gotta see. Proof.
That's right. Zero trust.
Well, this is fantastic, Cynthia. I appreciate you telling us the history of Key Resources and a bit about your transition into a software company, which clearly still has people involved. We can't forget the human element of all this. And we're glad you're in the business of helping to protect some of the most important systems in society. So thank you for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you very much.
We hope you enjoyed this conversation. If you learned something new and this story made you think, then share ITSPmagazine.com with your friends, family, and colleagues. We hope you will come back for more stories and follow us on our journey. You can always find us at the intersection of technology, cybersecurity, and society.